Welcome to Questions from the Audio Road. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford, and I'll be taking your calls and answering your questions for the next hour or so. Lisa is here with us, screening calls and keeping things light and fun. If you want to join in, simply press 1 on your phone, and Lisa will be right with you. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. Sit back, relax, and listen, or jump in and ask your question. You can even bring us your opinion. It's up to you. This is your show. You can ask questions about fuel mileage, tires, engine, EGR, aerodynamics, truck specking, maintenance, taxes, financial planning, getting started as an owner-operator, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the audio road.
Hi, this is Lisa. Remember to talk to Kevin. Press 1 so I can pick up the phone and screen your calls. You know you'd rather talk to me anyway. Or just sit back, relax, and listen to the show. And at any time you have a question, just hit 1 and I'll pick up the phone.
All right. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And we're going to get to the calls here in just a couple minutes. You know, I'm feeling a little generous today. So if you were listening to the show last night on SiriusXM, I talked about the question that I put up on Facebook, which was about merging. And I worded it in a very specific way. And I was looking for the correct answer. And there is a correct answer to this question. Now, I said I was going to wait all week until the weekend show to give you the answer. But I think I'm going to reward the people who are joining me for the podcast. So here's the way I worded the question. Heavy traffic on an interstate, two lanes merging down to one because of construction. Who causes more problems, the early mergers or the late mergers? And we're going to get the answer in just a second. It sounds like I've got some audio issues, though, so hold on just a second. All right, is that any better? I'm going to do a sound check with Lisa here and see if this is any better. Nope, still not good. Lisa, tell me what's going on. Static. I'm not hearing any static on my end. Lisa, I'm going to bring you on here. Tell me what's going on.
Hey, everyone. Hey, Kevin. Static only when you're talking.
Okay, even now when you're talking to me on the air?
Yep.
Yes. Bad static?
Kind of annoying static.
Is it? That's not good because I'm all set up with a bunch of new equipment and software here, and there's nothing I can do right now to change it, I don't believe.
Let's ask one of the callers to see if they're hearing the same thing that I'm hearing.
All right, let's bring Richard on in Detroit. Richard, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm hearing him.
Yay.
Oh, boy. Yeah, your sound is horrible, too, and I'm sure it's on my end, not yours. All right, hold on, everybody. I'm going to try something here, and we will be back. Give me 1 minute.
Thanks for tuning in to The Audio Road. If you have any questions, give us a call at 855-800-FUEL. That's 855-800-38.
All right, Lisa, any better? Huh. All right. Let me bring Lisa back on the air. Lisa, is this any better?
No, it's not any better. But I did just get a text saying that it's clear on the air. So I guess we can bring another caller on and ask him.
On the air.
Well,
what does that mean?
I guess them listening. So let's bring Trey in Mississippi on and see what if his sound is any better.
All right, let's try that. Trey in Mississippi, how does this sound to you?
Oh, you sound fine to me.
Huh, all right. Wonder what's going on here. Did that change the sound at all?
I was hearing a different on my coming through the air. Well, you sounded fine over the phone.
Okay. All right, sounds good. Up to you on hold, and we're going to try this out and see what happens. All right, Lisa, we ready?
We're ready.
All right, sorry about that. Let me just explain what we're doing. I'm working with some new hardware and new software. And since we're just getting back into the podcasting, I just want to build the best platform we can possibly build sound quality, make it easy for you to listen live, make it easy for you to listen later on to download the shows. So we're still playing around with some systems. So thanks for your patience. But let's go ahead and get right to some phone calls. Let's start off in Detroit. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How are you tonight?
Good. What can I help you with?
Well, I've got two. I told Lisa I had two questions. Actually, I have three, but the first two are quick ones regarding my gauges and fuel gauges. My gauges, I ran into a problem at the end of the year where my last settlement actually, I didn't get paid for it until the first settlement of this year. It's approximately $3,600. What do I add that into this year's, or do I just kind of break it out and put it back into December's?
Well, let's talk about that because we have to – one of the things we have to know is you're leased to a carrier, obviously, if you're getting a settlement. If the carrier handles this correctly, because you didn't receive the settlement till 2014, it's not considered income until 2014. The same with all the expenses that might be on that settlement. They're also not considered expenses until 2014. So the answer would be – you enter it with the date that's on it or the date that you received it. If those are different, then we've got to take a look at that. But the other question is, what is the carrier going to do on the 1099? Because what we want it to do is we want it to match what the 1099 is going to show. So if the carrier, because it was a weird center, it got delayed for some reason, if they leave it on 2013, then you should enter it as a 2013 settlement. If they're going to show it as 2014 income, then you should show it as a 2014 settlement.
Okay, yeah, no, they showed it as 2014. So
then that's the way you want to do it. So just, yeah, when you enter it into profit gauges, just date it in 2014.
Okay. My next question is regarding fuel gauges. I'm going to start using that. My question is, for a price of fuel, I'm a Canadian owner-operator, am I to break out the HST and the road tax to get what I'm actually paying for that fuel, or just what the total altogether?
The total price, what you paid at the pump, you don't have to subtract anything out because we keep it nice and simple. You're going to track your cost per mile on that fuel with all those things in it.
Okay. Is there any, down the road, is there going to be any add-ons for Canadians as far as the HST goes, areas we can use that with?
In profit gauges?
Yeah.
It's actually almost done. It's in beta testing right now. We're hoping to release it at the very latest by Louisville. We're actually a little ahead of schedule on some of those features, so we might get them out early.
Okay, that'd be great. Okay, as far as my third question goes regarding CMCs, I'm contemplating maybe coming down this year, but I don't really know what to expect. What's all involved? What's being presented? I noticed on the website it doesn't tell you a lot. I'm just wondering what's going to be on the agenda for the 5 days.
Yeah, it's everybody always wonders what to expect. I wonder what to expect. But I can tell you that it is a very, very full days. I usually do a part of every day. I either do the morning or the afternoon, or I do an open or a close, or I'm usually presenting something every day. And mine is all about the business itself. Big picture, details, goal setting, business planning, fuel mileage, taxes, accounting, fuel tax. I cover all kinds of things, and I do it all week long. We have our other speakers. Bruce Mallinson comes in and does a half day on engines and fuel mileage and performance. Mike Beckett comes in and does a half day on tires and alignment, tire wear, those kind of things. We have another speaker, George, who comes in and does two half days. We kind of break him up a little bit. He does two half days on, well, you know, we used to call it negotiating, and that's part of it, but it's really about communications and building relationships and negotiating. So there's an entire day broken up into two sections on that. Larry Wingett comes in and does his thing on one of the days. On Friday, a half day, we go outside, and it's a lot of hands-on workshops. So you can see maybe a fast system being installed, or you can see crank tests being done on the actual start module, or there's just all kinds of hands-on stations set up outside. In the evenings, we have some breakout sessions covering different things. There's really a lot. I mean, it's probably 10 hours every day.
All right. So it's something definitely to look at if you're looking at making the move from, let's say, Landstar to your own authority then.
So it really is for everybody. I mean, there's so much stuff. It's not specifically about getting your own authority, but we certainly cover all things that are going to help you tremendously in the business.
Yep. Okay, then. I appreciate your time once again. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go this time to Mississippi. Trey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you. I just got a quick question for you. I got a 2009 International ProStar, and it has the Eaton 10-speed automatic transmission. And sometimes when you, like, crank the truck up and you put your feet on the brake and then try to put it in gear, it won't go into gear. You get, like, the traction control light popped on, or the, the ABS light comes on. And sometimes you just remove your feet from the brake and wait a second and put it back on and try it again. It'll go in gear. And other times you have to turn the truck off and crank it back up and start over. So I just wondered if you maybe had an idea, maybe some of the other callers had an idea as to why we're doing that.
You know, sometimes it's just the way the truck gets stopped. Like, it's not quite in the spot that it needs to be to make contact, and just turning it off, or sometimes that. But if this starts happening more often, then it probably is a problem. One of the things that will do this, have you ever had the clutch brake adjusted?
I haven't.
In order to get into gear, the clutch brake needs to stop everything from turning. And you activate the clutch brake by pushing the clutch in all the way hard. Now, if that clutch brake is out of adjustment, then it's harder for the auto shift to get into gear. So what you might want to do is just make sure you're pushing the clutch in all the way before you try to get it in gear.
It's just two-pedal system, though, just an accelerator and a brake.
Oh, I'm sorry. I should have asked that. So Yeah, you got probably a sensor issue. Now, is this something that just happens once in a while, or is it starting to happen more often?
It's starting to happen a whole lot more often than it normally has been.
Yeah, that's a problem then. That's not just a matter of stopping in a funny spot and, you know, you've got... trying to think of what the most common cause of... What year is this one?
2009.
Has anybody looked at it yet?
No, I hadn't had a chance to look at it.
Yeah, I'm trying to... In that particular model, I'm not sure what the most common cause of this is going to be. The
Does
wiring harness
to do with, like,
itself...
Maybe traction control?
It shouldn't, but see, that's part of the problem. When we get tied in with so many sensors and the electronics start to get more and more complicated, then there are things like that that can cause issues. It's not very common, I can tell you that.
Okay.
It's one of the more common problems we see in transmission is the wiring harness itself from the shifter down to the transmission. So you might want to take that harness off, clean it up real well, check all the connections, check for corrosion, that kind of stuff, and put it back on and see if that helps.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate it. I'll maybe that helped out a lot.
And you're welcome. And we'll throw it out. Maybe somebody else who's had experience with that year will have another idea for us. I have to try something here before I go to the next call. I think I have most of the audio issues worked out. I am going to restart the show just so that I can see some of our other features are working and we get a good, clean recording. So here we go.
You're listening to Trucking Questions from the Audio Road with Kevin Rutherford. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. You can ask questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, tax, technology, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the audio road.
All right, everybody, welcome to the show, and we're going to jump right into some phone calls. We're off to New Jersey this time. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you tonight?
Doing good. What can I help you with?
I have a couple questions. I'm getting ready to add a truck, a driver. I have my own authority and everything.
Okay.
And I want to understand how to pay him per diem, if that'd be better for me to pay him per diem. And I'm also incorporating, so I'll be getting a paycheck too, or just have him claim per diem at the end of the year.
I understand. Do you have a good tax preparer?
Yeah, very good. But he tried to explain it to me, and he's good. I've been with the guy 20 years,
Okay.
Never added another truck.
Let me see if I can explain it, but I think what you're probably going to want to do is schedule an hour or two where you pay him to run some calculations for you, and I'll tell you why. On the surface, the per diem should help you to pay the per diem. Here's why. Every dollar you pay the driver as an employee, you have to pay half of the Social Security and Medicare. So
right.
That means, you know, roughly 7.65% of, so out of every $100 you pay him, $7.65 going to Social Security and Medicare. You've got to pay workers' comp. I have no idea what your workers' comp rate is because that's all over the board. So there might be a significant savings in workers' comp. You've got state unemployment and federal unemployment. That has a small effect on this. So when you pay them in per diem instead, you avoid all those costs. So there's definitely a savings there. The problem is, when you pay him in wages, you would get to deduct 100% of the wages. When you pay him in per diem, you get to deduct 80% because it's per diem.
Correct. So I'll be paying 20%.
Yeah, so
20%
right,
of the $59 I'll still be paying work comp and everything on?
No, you'll be paying income tax. You personally, the company, will have to pay tax on that 20%. Because you're not able to deduct the whole 100%. You're only deducting 80%. The other 20% just ends up being income to you, income to the company. So most of the time, there's still a pretty significant savings to pay per diem. That's why so many fleets do it.
Right. Pay them with a separate check, the per diem?
You don't have to, no. It can be included in the payroll check. Now, I like it when it shows up on the pay stub itself so everybody can see what's going on, but that's not necessary. I mean, you could and a lot of this depends on your software. If your payroll software allows taxable items to be added, most do. So you would show, you know, $800 of taxable wage, and then you might show, you know, $125 per diem, and that would be non-taxable, and it will be in the same check. It's just on the check stub, it should show up one's taxable, and you see all the deductions, and then the other one isn't.
Okay, so I'm having a little hard time with this. I know the per diem is $59. So
right.
When I pay him, let's say, just say weekly, how would that, am I paying him the $59 or 80% of it?
No, you can pay him the $59 as a per diem.
Okay.
And, you know, a lot of carriers have gone to a mileage rate, so it makes it easier. Now, the IRS says, okay, you just have to make sure that you don't overpay them. So if your mileage rate to the fact that some days it ends up being more than $59 a day, can't do that. You've got to stay at least $59 a day or less. You can't pay more than that, or it becomes taxable income to the employee and it makes a mess. So, but a lot of carriers go, well, if we pay them a mile, I'll never go over their $59 a day. For a small company, I think it's better to have your per diem 1 week behind. Your payroll is probably already a week behind anyway. And have
the driver
turn in his actual number of overnights, even with partials. You know, the day you leave is three quarters of a day. The day you come back is three quarters of a day. That way you get exactly the amount of per diem that he qualifies for.
Okay. Well, he's going to stay out 3 weeks at a time, so that should be pretty simple.
Yeah, that's going to be easy. So then when you get those numbers, you pay him the per diem or pay him whenever you want, but, you know, kind of keep track so you're paying him. As long as by the end of the year you haven't paid him more per diem than what he qualifies for, then you're fine.
Okay, I'm going to try to keep this simple. It might sound stupid, but let's just say he made $159 today. So then I would pay him $100 payroll and $59 per diem for today?
Exactly.
And then how does he claim that at the end of the year? Because he can only claim 20% of it. Or how does
he
that
doesn't.
Work for the employee?
No, the employee, it's really easy. He doesn't have to do anything at the end of the year. Now, he can't claim any per diem deduction because he already received all the money tax-free. So at the end of the year, he claims no per diem, but he still gets to take his standard deduction from the IRS.
So am I confused here? What? Now, if you did it at the end of the year, you're only claiming 80%, but now if I pay him that $159 he made that day at $59 in per diem, then he's got $59 tax-free. He gets more?
But you only get to claim 80% of that $59 as a deduction.
Right. Well, I'm going to be an employee, too, because I incorporated, so I'm trying to just completely understand it.
Yep.
And I know I might sound kind of dumb on it, but it was just
no, you don't.
I didn't understand.
This is really confusing. Most accounts I know don't know how to do this.
Right. So in other words, keep it simple, that's $159 a day. I'd pay him $100 payroll, $59 per diem.
Yep. Yep, and he doesn't have to do anything at the end of the year. You keep track of all the per diem you paid out, and the corporation actually deducts it as per diem, and they only get 80% of deduction.
At the end of the year, the corporation only gets 80% of what they paid out.
Okay. Right, but you save so much money in Social Security, Medicare, workers' comp, all that other stuff, so that there's still a savings.
Yeah, plus the employee has more take-home.
Right.
Weekly. Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm going to be running a dedicated run from Port of Miami up to Orlando, and I know that's your old stomping grounds, for about 6 or 7 weeks. Is there any way you could put me back to Lisa and she could give me some connections of the tire shop and the mechanical shop you use down there?
Yep, I will do that. And I didn't really have a tire shop. I had a mobile tire guy. We can give his name. A great guy. And I had a really good independent shop. And then the Detroit garage in Orlando was really good as well. Although it may not be good as it used to be because the service manager that I really liked has left. Let's go to Illinois. Cameron, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I'm wondering what's going on with California.
We're going to set some explosive devices and try to blast the whole state into the ocean and forget about them.
Well, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah, so I take it you need to go to California.
Well, I live in Arizona right on the California border, so I get loads that go into California to get home. And so, yeah, it's going to make it rather difficult.
Yeah, so, you know, it's so hard to tell. There's so much misinformation about California. There's so many changes constantly that I never feel very confident that I'm giving the right information. The last thing I heard, they talked about a 5,000-mile exemption, but that got very confusing because it sounds like they're only talking about trucks in the state of California. So that doesn't seem like that played out to be anything. We thought that was going to be a big deal. The other thing they've talked about, supposedly there are 4 reasons that they'll give you a 6-month extension. You've either applied for a new truck, ordered a new truck that's California compliant, or you've ordered a DPF and it's not in, that would make your truck California compliant. Or you have applied for a grant for a truck or applied for a grant for a DPF. Now, I think applying for the grants are only if you are a California resident. I think the only way you can apply for them. But it seems to me like they're being pretty lax about if you just can show them that you ordered a truck or ordered a DPF, they're going to give you a 6-month extension. Other than that, I have to believe that right at this minute, there are about 10,000 trucks in California that aren't compliant.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that number.
So I don't think there's a lot of enforcement going on, but I don't know how hard they're going to enforce it, how lenient they're going to be. Are they going to give people warnings? I just haven't heard any feedback on that yet, but you and I both know. There are a lot of trucks in and out of California right now that are not compliant.
Yeah. Yeah, that doesn't make it any easier. I don't want to drive in there, you know, and risk it.
Right. No, I agree. I wish I had a better answer. It is just so hard to get a good answer out of CARB, and every time I think I have a good answer, I read something somewhere else that changes my mind.
I know I went all through the website, and I couldn't make heads or tails of it. And I was actually looking for that 5,000-mile exemption, which would have worked for me. But
yeah, the 5,000-mile exemption would have worked for a lot of people, and I think it would have been the smartest thing that CARB could have done. It would have eased this whole transition, and now came out with some weird thing with that was only, you know, trucks that that was 5,000 miles everywhere. It was very confusing. They backpedaled right away because everybody interpreted it to mean you could drive up to 5,000 miles a year in California without being compliant. That's what they made it sound like. Right away, they backpedaled on that and said that wasn't the case.
Okay, well, thanks, Kevin. I guess we'll just try to stay out of California.
Yeah, that's certainly my best advice. I wish I had a better answer. It's just so hard understanding what they're doing over there. Let's go to New Mexico. JR, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. What can I help you with?
I got a couple of questions, both of them regarding fuel mileage. One, my 14-liter Detroit, for some reason, since the winter blend became the diesel to buy, for some reason it's clogging my fuel filters. And I was going to ask you if you knew anything about injector settings in the computer and if somebody went in there and jacked them up to the highest XOL of your fuel filter.
Oh, you were breaking up a little bit there, so I am going to try to answer the two questions the way I think I heard them. If you've got filters clogging up, if it was really cold, it could be that you had fuel gelling and waxing, and if it wasn't really cold, then odds are you very well could have algae. You have to determine which one. If it was really cold, I would chalk it up to gelling. There was a lot of that going on, and you might want to get a good winter additive to help with that. If it wasn't that cold and your filters are clogging, that is almost always algae. And you can cut a filter open. You can look in your tanks. If it's algae, you need to get a good biocide or an algicide. I would go to West Marine and get a Startron. It's a good additive for algae. And on the injectors, yes, there are people that go in and screw around with the injector settings, and they think they're doing something good, and they're usually not. They're screwing up the injectors when they set those codes across the board. That's not the way it should be done. So I don't know what somebody's done in yours, but if you suspect that somebody changed that, you might want to get it into some place you trust and get it checked. Let's go to Louisiana. Adrian, welcome to the program. Adrian, going once.
Yeah, you there?
Oh, there you are. Go ahead.
Hey, I just had a repair done on my truck. My pre-cooler on my C15 went out, and they changed it over to red coolant instead of the green coolant, and I've never run red coolant in a truck before, and they were telling me that I don't need to do anything to it, like I don't need to add like pen cool or anything like that. And I wanted to get your advice on just what to do to maintain my coolant now that it's the extended life.
Got it. What year is your truck?
It's an 06 engine.
You should have had extended life right from the start. I don't know why you didn't. But that truck really should have extended life in it. And they are correct. The difference between standard life coolants and long life for extended life coolants is the additive package. In fact, that's the only difference. Other than that, they're both glycol and water. Coolants are all the same. And then there's an additive package. And in the extended life, the additive package is good for at least 500,000 miles. I think they actually claim 600,000. So you don't need to recharge the extended life coolant. You don't need to add any more additives. You don't need to put on a water filter the way we used to.
Right.
You just put it in there. It doesn't hurt to test it a couple times a year. Make sure you've got the right test strips for extended life. But other than that, you don't have to do anything to it.
Okay, so if the test strip comes back and it's saying it's low on nitrates or whatever, you still could add, like, pen cool to it, but
no.
You shouldn't need to.
No, Nope, it won't. It won't come back with additive levels low. We're looking for other things on the test. But, yeah, it should come back just fine.
Oh, okay. Like it might say that it the freeze point is too high or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Right. That's the kind of stuff we're looking for in the condition of the extended life.
Okay. I got one more question for you, if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead.
You know how you talk about, like, running in overdrive, you get worse fuel mileage. Now, I was wondering how that works on the other side. Like, say you have a 13-speed and 11th is direct drive. What if you're running in 9th or 8th or something like that? Is it the same kind of thing where if it's not in 1-to-1, you're using more gears and causing more friction?
It's a little different. It's not quite the same. There is more gear churn and more oil churn in any gear other than direct. Direct gear has the least amount of churn and mechanical drag. So that there is an advantage to being in direct rather than an overdrive or an underdrive. Now, overdrive is worse because not only do you have the oil churn going on, but you've also got a mechanical disadvantage happening. So it's harder for the engine to propel the vehicle in an overdrive gear because it's an overdrive. It's got a mechanical disadvantage. An underdrive has a mechanical advantage. Now, it's not really going to help fuel mileage down the road, but it's going to hurt it the way being in overdrive does. So you still have the oil churn and the other things going on. So direct gear is your best gear beat.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate your time, Kevin, and keep doing what you're doing.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Georgia this time. Paul, welcome to the program.
Howdy. Happy New Year.
What's up, Dave?
Much would it cost for one of those Maxwell stop modules? What would the cost of that be?
I have seen prices. I think the cheapest I've seen it is $780, and the most expensive I've seen is about $1,100.
Okay. Does that include installation, or is that above that?
That's just the unit itself, and depending on the truck, you're probably looking at 2 hours labor to get it installed.
Okay. I've got a comment about the how to merge. I think
yes.
Everybody, truck drivers, four-wheelers, motorcycles, whoever, everybody should run all of the open lanes right to the very end, and then you take your turn, merge like a zipper. Because the guys that queue up 2, 3, 4 miles back, all they do is make a single line way longer, and it takes longer, in my opinion.
Yeah, I told everybody, since you guys are dedicated podcast listeners, that I'm going to let you guys in, so glad you reminded me, and you are exactly correct. And there has been a lot of research on this. And the early mergers, and I know this is going to piss a lot of people off. They're not going to believe it. It's early mergers that cause problems. Now, the reason we don't want to believe that is because we've all been taught that those are the courteous people. You know, the nice people, the ones who aren't looking out for themselves, are the ones that try to get into the right lane as soon as possible. We think being nice would do that. The problem is we're the ones screwing the traffic. And I put myself in that group. I used to, as soon as I knew which lane was open, that was the lane I tried to move into, thinking I'm helping things out here. I'll get over into the lane early so everybody isn't fighting over a lane. Turn out that's the worst. Well, no, the worst, and this is going to piss even more people off, the worst is when two trucks run side by side and try to block everybody. Because now you're losing all the available space in the open lane, and you keep changing the merge point. As those trucks roll down the road, the merge point keeps changing, and it causes more havoc. So a lot of states now are going to a system of when you're heading into construction, they want you to stay in the lane you're in. and stay there until the merge point and then take turns merging. Now, the people who want to argue about this are going to say, yeah, but that doesn't work because people won't merge right. I agree. People aren't going to merge right. They're going to fight over it. But that doesn't change the fact that this is still the best way to do it. Every other way causes longer backups and more accidents. When you have people merging at 60 miles an hour, 40 miles an hour, 30 miles an hour, 20 miles an hour, that's when the accidents happen. If everybody uses all the available space right down to the merge point, by that time you're down to almost no speed. You take turns in and out just like a zipper. Traffic flows through faster, and there are less accidents and less road rage.
Yeah, well, I've been cussed that a few times, but it's water off a duck's back to me. My initials might be PC, but I'm not. So,
yeah. That's right. So there's the answer. Now, I know I'm going to get a ton of arguing about this because right now I'm keeping track. I've had over 300 responses. It's running. There are a lot of people that just have this wrong. There are, and here's the other thing. The people who have it wrong, meaning they believe that it's the late mergers that screw everything up, and those people are arrogant and selfish, and they seem to be also most emotional about this. They're not going to want to admit that they might have gotten this one wrong. I can see it already. The people who have been exposed, there's been a lot of research on this, and understand that you use all the available space. We want a big, long lane open. We want to use that space. And then we want to merge one at a time like a zipper at the very last minute, right at the merge point, not before. The people who seem to know that's correct, and wherever they've learned it, doesn't matter, they seem to be more logical about it. I was wrong. Once I studied it and thought about it, I got it right. But the whole time I drove, up until now, I mean, I'm going to change the way I do this. I'll be the idiot everybody will be yelling at because I'm going to turn into a merger. I'm going to stay in whatever lane I'm in when I see the sign. And if that means I have to merge at the last minute because I'm in the wrong lane, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a late merger. I'm open to the fact that, guess what? I was wrong about this all these years. I thought I was being the nice guy, moving in nice and early, paying attention. I thought I was helping. I'm not. Part of this, remember, just an experiment to see how open people can be to new information when they're exposed to it. I think there are going to be a lot of people not very open about this. Let's go to Texas. Juan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Yeah, I'd be one of those that are not acceptance of it because we live in the real world. Not in if everything goes perfect.
I understand that. I do. But even given the fact that we have a bunch of drivers who don't know how to do this, who are going to screw it all up, it doesn't change the fact. And the idea is we should, as professional drivers, try to get the word out and get people to change. Now, I know how impossible that's going to be, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't tell people what the right way is, and we shouldn't try to start doing it ourselves.
Well, and that makes sense. Getting them to accept it will be a total different thing. And check this out. When you're over on that left lane and everybody sees you in the left lane and is mad at you, when you try to merge, they're going to say, no, you should have got in your right lane a long time ago.
Yeah, I'm just going to deal with it. And you know, in a truck, it's pretty easy. Just move over. They'll get out of the way.
They will do that. They will do that. Anyway, my call, well, he stole my thunder. I was going to say you told us last night what you thought about it just because I know you think logically, and I figured that was your position before. So it had to have been this new approach in order to make it interesting. So I was gonna tell you I said, but you stole it. But anyway, I called last night also, and I got cut off there at the end. I got a friend who's having a problem with his Jake brake, with the engine brake, and he's taken it to several shops. but because it only does it every once in a while, and what I mean by it only does it, every once in a while, it just comes on. Without him turning on the Jake brake, it just comes on. It's not very strong, apparently, but so he's taken it to a few shops. They cleaned out the switch, and I think another shop actually exchanged the switch where you turn the Jake brake on. And he's still, after he leaves there, he thinks it's fixed, but even today it's not fixed. So we were wondering, is there a fuse or some he never goes where he needs it. Is there a way to disengage it? Do you know of an easy way to disengage the engine brake?
There should. What year and what truck?
Kenworth. It's 07 or 08. Kenworth with a cat.
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that. I've never been asked to disable a Jake brake before. Boy, it would seem like it should have. Has he looked for a fuse?
I know that he went in there looking. Yes, he did, actually, now that I think about it. And he didn't see anything that said, you know, anything that obvious, but...
Boy, you would think it if it's. I can't believe I don't know the answer to this one. This seems like one of those obvious questions, and yet never thought about it. I don't know. I'm gonna have to do a little research on that.
Yeah, or maybe somebody that's listening that knows or something. But because I listen to you all the time, and you know, I listen to you all the time. And one thing. Moving on to one other little thing. One thing I've never heard you say is, I hear you talk about 376s or 370s, the ratio, but I never understand, where do I get that number? How do we know, like, I'm an owner-operator, and I know it's a shame, but I don't know my ratio, my gear to differential, is that what it is, or where do I get those
370s? Talk about gear ratios, we're talking about differential. Your rear end differentials, and what the ratio means is that for every turn of the input, every turn of the drive shaft, how many turns of the wheel are you going to get? So it, or I might have gotten that backwards. Yeah, I've got it backwards. It's the other way around. So when we say the ratio, we say 355, but what it really should be is, the correct way is 3.55 to 1. So it's a ratio. For every 3.55 turns, you're getting one turn. The different gear sizes will give you different number of turns, a different ratio. So the higher the number, the lower the gear ratio actually is, the lower the gearing. The lower the number, the higher the gearing, the faster the truck will go with higher gearing. It'll go slower with lower gearing. So 390s are really low gears. 250s are really high gears. Now, as far as where you get it, a couple places you can get it. Some trucks have it right inside the door on the manufacturer's stamp. A lot of times the Freightliners will be right inside the door. Some of them have it under the fuse block cover. If you can't find it anywhere, you can usually take your VIN number and call a truck dealer, your manufacturer's dealer, and they should be able to look it up. Or it can also be calculated. Now, sometimes when we calculate it, we fall right in the middle. Usually I can calculate it pretty close based on your RPM at a certain speed, and then I need to know what transmission you have and what tire size, and I can kind of calculate it. But you might be able to find it on the truck, or the dealer can tell you with the VIN number.
Nice, nice. I can't tell you how many times I was frustrated listening to radio because y'all talk about it so much, but I'm always like, well, where do I get these numbers? And I never, it's so simple.
Yeah.
I never thought about just taking the VIN number and going to the – question that was a mystery to me for a while. Well, thanks. That's all I have. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Texas. Adam, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Good afternoon or good evening.
I just wanted you to take a look at my my profit gauges. I'm all done for the year, for last year, and I just wanted you to take a look to make sure that the last few days, the crazy questions about LLCs and S corporations is validated by what my numbers say.
Yeah, let's go in and take a look and see what we've got. So how does it feel to have all of your accounting for the year done?
I don't know. We'll have to call the wife and ask.
Yeah, there you go. Well, it's definitely better than not having it all done. All right, so let's go.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a look at the whole year first. I'm going to go to your business report in profit gauges. We're going to look at the year.
It was a crazy year. This year will be a lot more stable.
Yeah. Now, you also said, though, that your best months were at the end of the year, right?
Yeah, I think I started this doing the garlic. I want to say maybe July, end of July, beginning of August, perhaps.
Okay, so you had a great year. I mean, even though there was a lot of turmoil in the beginning, you didn't start this more profitable run till later, you ended up with $88,000 before tax. So even after we take some depreciation, you're going to be right up there where you need to be incorporated. And if we have a whole year of this kind, so let me take a look at December. Wow. December was nice.
That should be for the next November, 12 months like that.
Then there's no question. If you have 12 months that look even if they were half of this, you would need to be incorporated.
Well, you know, I feel blessed for what I have and been able lucky to take opportunities and I just feel grateful for everything. I do have one other question though that was brought to my attention today about. I bought the trailer. You know, we had talked about getting a trailer when I was, you know, using somebody else's. And so now I have my own trailer. And it came with the steel wheels. And, you know, I've been getting rid of the recaps that the company put on them when I bought it. But I haven't gone and bought all new tires. And they're 22.5s on my trailer. And my truck are 24.5s. And someone had mentioned to me today, and I never thought about it, so I thought I'd ask you, if I went and traded in, does this make sense? If I went and traded in the 22.5s for 24.5s rims, put my drive tires on my trailer, which are good rolling resistance, and went and bought new steer tire or drive tires instead of buying all tires and used my, you know, drive tires as...
No.
Okay.
No. Here's why. We want to work towards the lowest possible rolling resistance in all places. And you're going to be doing a lot of buying and shipping and going to end up with stuff you don't want. We'd rather have 22.5. That's just...
Right.
22.5 is better. So I don't want you to go buy more 24.5. If you've got 22.5 on the trailer, leave them on there. I don't want you to put drive tires on the trailer because the trailer is the most important position, and you can get trailer tires that are down in the 70s for rolling resistance.
Right, right. Well, what's other than the Super Singles, for what's the best rolling resistance tire for trailer?
You could go with the XTE, not the wide single, the Michelin XTE. I think Yokohama's got a really low rolling resistance trailer tire. I don't have those memorized, so I'd have to go look those up. But you could go look it up. I wouldn't put on 24.5s, and I wouldn't move your drive tires back. You want to start working towards getting the lowest possible rolling resistance in every position, and start with the trailer first.
Right. Right, right. I like I said, I did price out my tires for the trailer. I was just waiting for to get a little bit warmer because I haven't really had any issues even with the recaps at the moment just because of the weather.
Okay.
So
now
or the recaps,
I'm
going to
check something for you real quick because Matt just sent me a message saying it's in the singles or in the dual. It might be the Matt says it's the XTA that has the low rolling resistance, not the XTE. So I'm just going to check real quick here. The XTE is 98. The XTA energy is 85. So
oh, wow.
That's a good low. But I think there are actually, is it Continental, where somebody has a dual trailer tire that's in the 70s, I think.
Yeah, 77.
Yeah.
I think it's Continental.
So as much as I like Michelin, I love Michelin tires, but I think in that trailer position, wasn't going with wide singles, I might look at a Continental or if somebody had something down in the 70s, I might give it a shot.
All right, I will definitely do that and leave my positions alone until I can get some new rims for the truck.
There you go. That'll work. Thanks for the call. All right. You know, we are coming up on the end of the hour here. I'm scanning through the calls. I've got another one here. Let's go to California. Emerson, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I've got a scan gauge, and I wish I could say I got that magical half-mile-per-gallon improvement, but we're still working on it.
Keep working on it. You'll get there.
Well, it is fun to play with it and do different things, and we're looking at differences between my driving style and my wife and a little friendly competition.
That is fun.
She's winning, and she's a new driver. So.
That's interesting.
Mostly the grapevine and running the fiskies. That's where she beats me, but heavy foot,
got
I guess.
Got it.
What I found that I'm puzzled, the scan gauge, obviously running it through the diagnostic port, I've got it set so where I can read my boost, and I've got a manifold pressure gauge, basically boost gauge, and when I'm running the mountains, and sometimes just to test it, I'll get maximum boost, and my gauge will peg out at 30 pounds, 30, 31. I got an ISX set at 450 horsepower, 1710 on the torque, and I've got a 13-speed ultra auto shift with 355 gearing. So we can fine-tune what we're doing for gearing and climbing and getting the best. But
okay.
To play with it and get the maximum boost and put it about 30 pounds, about a third of the time, the scan gauge will read 65 to 70 pounds, and that's reading what's actually happening with the ECM, I think. So where am I coming up different, or what do I do?
Very common question. Now, the thing is, they're both correct, believe it or not. But it would be
okay.
It's like trying to compare gallons to liters. You know, a gallon is a gallon, and we know what it is. But a liter is something totally different. Now, it's still a measurement. We look at a liter. We know how much a liter is. It's hard to compare the two because they don't really have anything to do with each other. The scan gauge, trying to remember the technical explanation for this. The scan gauge is calculating in a different form. It's inches of mercury. I'm probably going to get the technical explanation wrong, but we're calculating it in a different manner. And that's why we end up with a different reading. They're both useful. You just can't compare the two.
It's
work in gallons or you work in liters, and you can make either one of them work. You just can't compare the two. I think in inches of mercury, and that's why it comes up almost, it's a little more than twice as much. It's like the conversion is like 2.1 or something close to that.
Okay, that one makes sense, but it switches kind of indiscriminately, and that's what kind of puzzled me. I do have sort of a related question. My truck runs pretty consistent. Climbing the Ashland Summit, I'll go up the hill 27 miles an hour, about 1,400 RPM. Yesterday climbing the hill, doing everything the same. Truck ran great, going up at 33 miles an hour, still pulling 1,400 RPM, same gear. And just felt like it was happier. You just felt running better. And I don't know what to attribute it to. I don't know if, and I've replaced the fuel lines. I'm thinking maybe there's, you know, maybe less fuel restriction that day, better batch of fuel. I don't know. I want to do it again,
you
because
know,
my mileage is improved too.
Yeah, sometimes it can be just a combination of fuel quality and atmospheric conditions. You know, the right temperature, the right humidity, everything's working really well. You've got good fuel. Sometimes that's just all it is. We do want to keep an eye on it, though, because, you know, if you start seeing noticeable differences, then it's probably mechanical. What
well,
year did you say this was?
It's an 08 386 Peterbilt.
Yeah, so then
I dropped as much.
Yeah. The other variable here is with any of the engines, we see so many things like this, and it's so hard to figure out and explain and know what's going on. We still use our normal troubleshooting. We watch the fuel mileage real close. We watch our oil samples. We look for anything that indicates that there's a mechanical problem. But these engines just aren't as consistent. I mean, we do see this stuff with the newer engines.
Well, I'm due for an oil sample. That's the next thing, but I'll be there in May. So between all the geniuses, we can look at it at the CMC and maybe delve into the ECM and try and tune it better and go from there.
Sounds like a winner. Sounds like a winner.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. All right. I know we've got a ton of calls and questions. The podcast is getting very popular. We blew out the phone lines tonight. So we're not going to be able to get to all the calls. We are looking at, I don't see it happening, you know, anytime in the near future, but we are looking at expanding our podcast hours, maybe turning this into a 2-hour show, maybe doing some guest host and some other things. So I know we didn't get everybody, but stick with us. We're going to continue to grow this format and do more and more of the podcasting. And like I say, we're looking at other ideas. Next week, if I can get time, I might try to get Mike Beckett to come on and co-host with me next week. We can talk about tires and alignment. Bruce Mallinson is offered to come on anytime. We certainly get him back. And I've got lots of other ideas. Larry Winget has said he'll come on and do the show with us, so we're going to have Larry Winget with us as well. All right, I'm all out of time. I've got to get out of here. Thanks for joining me, and we'll see you here next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work.
Thanks for tuning
and master the journey.
Road.
Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
At 855-800-FUEL. That's 855-800-3835. Check out the website at letstruck.com and find us on facebook.com/letstruck.